you're a culture without a compass. A macabre reprise of first century Rome, when Saturday Night Live meant live lions regurgitating pieces of Christian children. We've completed the free fall from a society with discreet, private, meaningful lives, bounded by self-respect, to a vicarious universe ruled by tabloid television. Celebrities wax, wane, strip, mate, marry, quarrel, divorce, slay, gain and lose weight, give each other prizes, write books, commit suicide, spew thoughtless rubbish, and tirelessly present themselves without shame or intelligible context. We loll in the gallery like cretins at a Punch and Judy, cheering, jeering, hooting, or gasping as the action strikes us.
Columnist Hal Crowther, he's here to talk about his new book, Unarmed But Dangerous. Welcome to Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. After earning his journalistic spurs at Newsweek, Time, and the Buffalo News, Hal Crowther began writing for North Carolina audiences. His work now appears in The Independent, a weekly in Durham, and is syndicated in 24 other newspapers. Among his favorite targets are polluters, politicians, and image mongers. In short, as Crowther says, everyone who sold decency and integrity down the river in the name of the almighty dollar. Hal Crowther's new collection is Unarmed But Dangerous, subtitled Withering Attacks on All Things Phony, Foolish, and Fundamentally Wrong with America Today.
Actually, that title came from my friend John Shelton Reed, one of my more conservative friends, and we had not chosen a title, and one of the things we have argued about from time to time is firearms. And he just you know, as a joke, said, "What about unarmed but dangerous?"
Well, it works.
And that
it's
was
great.
The one they liked. So,
let's talk about this book that you have put together. Man, oh man, you go after everybody and everything in this book. You wear the weight, the mantle of H.L. Mencken. We'll come to him in just a few minutes. Let's begin with journalism and mass media. Are you chewing on the same ankle here? Is that your ankle you're chewing on here when all the complaining you do in this book?
I don't think any of us can distance ourselves from the mess that, you know, the media are making of you know, almost our entire culture. It you know, is a fairly easy thing to trace, I think. At one time, there were many outlets, and all of them were making a lot of money, and some of them were responsible, and some of them weren't. And now there are very few outlets, and they're all arms of enormous corporations, and they all have to deliver a certain profit level, and they're pandering to people. They're giving people what, you know, they think the people are asking for instead of what the people need. And it's getting out of control, I think, as the Simpson case has shown more than anything else.
Well, how would you characterize journalistic responsibility, Hal? What does that amount to for you?
To honestly believe that it's your responsibility to provide people with information that they can't acquire for themselves, not to amuse them, not to you know, keep them sort of chewing on the same cud endlessly as long as it's profitable for you, but to really feel a responsibility, because, I mean, we have the ability to get a hold of a lot of information that the average individual cannot. And for us to bury or slant or ignore this information in favor of utterly useless information is irresponsible and ultimately, I think, destructive of a democracy.
I noticed that you, one of the books that you cite in this, in your collection of pieces, Hal, is Professor Postman, A Culture That Is Amusing Itself to Death. And I mean, you even go so far as to say that we are witnessing here at the end of the 20th century the death of American culture. Now, man, that's pretty strong stuff.
Neil Postman has always, you know, been one of my role models. I think, you know, I think he takes a very historical point of view. I mean, you know, he goes back and shows you that the language of the Lincoln-Douglas debates was lofty, you know, to farmers sitting in their wagons was lofty. It was almost the language of the Roman Senate. And if anyone used language like that today, either in a, you know, in a media or a political context, it would seem, you know, like tenured professors arguing in their libraries. I mean, no one would accept it. No one would even listen to it. I really think that the situation is that bad. I think if you watch some of these daytime television shows and read some of these tabloids, I just think we've reached a point where we can't do anything except try to grow again because we can't get any lower.
Now, you write about American commercial mass culture, and that in itself presents you with a large contradiction, doesn't it? I mean, the basis of American triumphalism, getting where we got, being as great as we are, goes back to our commercial culture, and yet you go after it in uncertain, strong terms. How about it?
Well, everything in its balance, you know. I think all this business now about shrinking government and so on, I think most of the people who parrot these slogans are people who, for some reason, assume that they are people who would prevail if there were no referee, which is very amusing, you know. And the only people who really would gain from shrinking the federal government to the point where it was virtually impotent, the only ones that would gain, of course, would be these enormous corporations. And they're those that have been beating the drum against all regulation, against, you know, every FCC, which they've virtually, were put out of existence.
Oh, well, radio is utterly deregulated, right. And television is headed in that direction.
The EPA and the FTC and on and on. I mean, the only person who really benefits from shrinking government, you know, beyond a certain point, is these big corporations, and yet somehow it's been taken up as a cry by people who would be utterly swallowed and crushed if the federal government ever, you know, stepped back and allowed it to be, you know, played strictly one savage against another.
Who are the villains out there when we speak, when you speak, Hal Crowther, about the politicians and the ideologues? Does it always fall out along partisan lines, the liberals versus the conservatives, that kind of thing?
Well, there's hardly any respectable liberal voice left, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I'm not politically correct. I'm actually criticized more, I think, or at least in a more angry way, from the left than from the right. The kind of left that I believe in, you know, the left that believes in social justice and just simply trying to keep things as fair as possible by watching who has the power and stepping in when it gets out of control.
Right.
That kind of liberalism has somehow been discredited, and the people who represented it have somehow been silenced. Somehow you just don't even hear the right voices anymore. Oddly enough, at many times there was a much better language, much better logic in our discourse than there is now. I think, unfortunately, the mass media, the electronic media, have made it possible to do this sort of soundbite, quick image, quick cut, mm-hmm. to the point where they've learned how to influence people with the techniques of advertising.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's been a decline not only in public discourse, but in education that can be traced, unfortunately, to the dawn of television.
Well, now, I remember a column you did a long time ago, and you revisit this topic occasionally, Hal. Was it 7 reasons, 10 reasons, 8 reasons for abolishing television, just giving it up? And I remember reading that and thinking, man, this guy's lost touch with reality. TV is a fact of life. It's always going to be there. To be honest with you, I think I'm coming around to this point of view. How about it?
That was a historic book for arguments, I think, for them. Actually, there were about 30, but he put them in four. Gerrymander.
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 Right. Great name.
His real name. But he really was a prophet.
Uh-huh.
And another prophet was E.B. White, who said in 1938, I believe that our civilization will rise or fall on this invention. This is when almost no one had even seen a television. Talk about prophetic.
Yeah, he says it's going to be a great white radiant light in the sky, or it's going to be this awful morass. Mm-hmm. Absolutely ahead of his time.
We turned it over to people who, you know, were using it in the most self-serving way, and we failed to control them properly.
Now, are we sounding here together, Hal Crowther, like a couple of snobs preaching to the unwashed masses? I mean, there are people out there who are going to hear this conversation and say, give me a break. TV isn't so bad. It appeals. It unites us. It is a mass medium. Isn't that a good thing?
When I was a television critic, my line was that it doesn't matter what's on. In other words, I wasted no time telling people how dreadful the programming was, which
right.
It usually was, although it was better in my day 20 years ago when I was writing about television for Newsweek.
Right.
It was better then than it is now in general. But all I said is it's the medium itself. I said that the result of watching this thing 4, 6, 7 hours a day, as the average American does. In other words, if you put in someone like me who watches, you know, the World Series and the Final Four, and imagine how many hours someone else has to watch to even us out at 6 or 7. But I think, you know, that finally what you've got is an effect on the evolution of the human race. I mean, we're not intended to stare at a glowing square. And this is the terrifying thing about people who think that the future is the internet.
Right.
I mean, the internet is going to be very useful, and it's going to be wonderful for a lot of special groups.
Mm-hmm.
But how many hours a day can people stare at a glowing screen?
Well, I hesitate to ask you about it, but let's take it on, the O.J. Simpson case. What about it? How do you fall? Too much coverage? The wrong kind of coverage? What?
Well, it just came along at a time when the country had already been primed, you know, to turn all its attention to something that is, in essence, simple and in some ways very tragic and, you know, interesting story in its original shape. And somehow turned it into 2 years of entertainment in which, you know, the sort of bit players become major figures. And, you know, people like that witness there that I keep seeing article after article on,
this poor
young man who apparently slightly disturbed.
Can't we make the argument that after a fashion, this is a form of legal education for a lot of people? Do we have to come down completely cynically, negatively on the side of infotainment, the cheapening of our legal values? What?
I think what we're seeing, though, is that, you know, is a culture that will give the smaller story, the less important story, the tabloid story, all the attention. I mean, I don't know how many Rwandas or how many Yugoslavias have been totally ignored during the time that we've been fascinated with.
Well,
this one,
when the Oklahoma City bombing took place, O.J. disappeared from the pages. Does that mean that we're journalistically back on the mark?
That's about what it takes, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But in another 3 or 4 weeks, O.J. will be back and the bombing will be gone.
All right. Again, your wonderful range of topics, Hal Crowther, in Unarmed But Dangerous, drugs, AIDS, youth, violence in the cities and the home and the heartland, sex and gender, men and women. How do you pick your fights? How do you pick your topics?
I think it's inevitable that you go toward things, you know, where you feel you have something personal invested. I mean, I have the good fortune to be able to choose my topics, to never be pointed in any particular direction by anyone. And as the years go by, I find myself less interested in fighting, national policy battles.
Uh-huh.
Just tired, actually. Tired of losing, for one thing. Tired of you know, saying...
I think you're selling yourself short on that.
Well, I over the years, you know, there's a few things that I've regarded as totally beyond argument. That we must control firearms. That the death penalty is totally unfair and ineffective and has no purpose whatsoever except, you know, revenge for people who are vengeful.
Uh-huh.
There's only a few. I mean, most things there are two sides. But all those things where I have taken all my eloquence to show you that there's only one side, I feel that I have lost. I mean, over the time that I've been working, policy and politics and so on have gone in the other direction. It's very discouraging.
Now, when it comes to let's pick the word here carefully. Not lesser issues, but issues of less magnitude than the death penalty and gun control, things like that. Do you worry about being consistent? Do you worry about being, saying today what you said a few years ago? How does that work for you?
I try to trace any changes. You know, I don't feel, in all these years, everyone wants to point out the things that he said before anyone else said. But, you know, I was making fun of Cold War thinking 10 years before anyone else was, and no one listened to me then, but maybe they are beginning to now.
Right.
But over the years, I've never found any drum that I beat that was the wrong drum. Where I, you know, in my opinion, I mean, I've never gone back and said, oh my God, you know, did I ever blow that one? But certainly I used inappropriate rhetoric, at times, and to make a point or to hit back at an enemy. I've said things in a manner that I would change.
Hal, do you worry about being self-righteous, moralistic, preachy? I mean, these are the very types that you love to go after in your columns. What about that?
I certainly have a preacher's instinct. I try to soften.
You call yourself a missionary at one point.
Yeah, I try to soften that because these are basically personal essays. They're sort of halfway between newspaper columns and personal essays. I soften it by a persona, you know, which I think is quite accurate of myself as a person who's sometimes hapless and shouldn't be taken too seriously in a lot of areas, because I know that I really do. And I like to preach, and I think it's my responsibility to preach. I mean, I've always had this idea that if you have access to information that other people don't have, and access to arguments and so on, that it's your duty to get it out there. You know,
now,
that's what I try to do. I know it. No, you're right, though. It does sound very self-righteous to some people.
Well, what I was going to ask you is this: do you want people to think the way you think, or do you want to just get them thinking? What's your responsibility?
I want them to examine these issues that these things that they take for granted. Mm-hmm. I have no. I don't belong to any party. I don't belong to any group. I'm not selling anything. I have no agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And I very much just, I'm out there trying to find bad reasoning and bad faith and mean-spiritedness,
right,
and hopefully smoke it out. I mean, that's the purpose of the column, I think.
Let's come to some specifics here. Let me put a few words on the table and you react to them. Madonna?
Well, she's sort of, the precursor to the OJ era, a person who absolutely constructed herself out of public relations. I mean, a person who has no ability, is remarkable in no way except her determination to be famous.
The distinction between the hero and the celebrity, is that what we're after?
Yeah, well, we now live in an age where public relations utterly creates what we call celebrities. It used to be, once upon a time, half the celebrities, at least, were people with some ability.
Right.
You know, they could sing, they could, they were physicists and aviators and writers and leaders of different kinds. I mean, they had gifts. Now, 2/3 of the celebrities, maybe 3/4, maybe 90%, are people who have no ability except to put themselves forward.
Big time sports. We've just come out of the baseball strike. We're recording this conversation in the spring of 95. Where are we headed in that regard?
Well, that was kind of heartbreaking for me because I am a baseball fan, and baseball players, at least, are people who do have a very distinctive ability and one that's very difficult to acquire. I mean, I've always admired them. I'm not a team fan or anything. I've just admired the people who play the game best, And I think that game and all its traditions and so on have been totally destroyed by the same kind of greed and stupidity in commerce. I mean, once upon a time, owners were local rich men who wanted to meet the players, basically, or willing to make very little money or even lose money because they were fans. Now they're enormously wealthy men, billionaires, some of them, or corporations who are trying to get into this television money, and it's a whole different thing. And the game, as I loved it, is, I think, pretty much shot. I'm very pessimistic about baseball.
Hal, your book is Unarmed But Dangerous. I can't let you get away without hearing your comments about talk radio.
I think that the president has touched something that's very important, and I think he's actually not pressing it as much as he should. I think that this absolutely incontinent rhetoric, this ferocious rhetoric, this denunciation of the president and the president's wife and so on, in these almost military terms. I mean, not everyone is an entertainer who understands the uses of rhetoric. A lot of people are very literal-minded.
They're susceptible.
Very susceptible.
All right, so what happens to free speech in this argument?
I live off free speech. I would march in the rain for the right of Rush Limbaugh to say what he says. All
so
right?
We're back to what? Taste, moderation, sensibility rather than politics?
All we can really do, in my opinion, although I think we have to look at the First Amendment in terms of people who are selling stuff to children. I mean, I do think that the First Amendment applies only to adults, and that's a long argument that we get into another time. But terrible things are being sold commercially to people who are not old enough to begin to understand what they're consuming.
Uh-huh.
But when you're talking about adults, all we can do is have try to regain something like community pressure, some sort of an idea that if you preach hatred and bigotry and craziness. A lot of these, I mean, just you listen to some of these talk show hosts, and they know that this stuff works. A lot of them, I think, are intelligent enough not really to totally believe it themselves, but they know what'll keep the phones ringing.
Absolutely.
And it's dreadfully irresponsible, and I think only when they're treated like child molesters and polluters and so on, when people really come around to making them ashamed of themselves. And I don't know if there's any force, any more like that. The idea of a community will turn on a member, of the community that's no longer holding up its end.
Hal Crowther, your book is Unarmed But Dangerous. Speaking of being armed or unarmed, what about the NRA? That's one of your targets, huh?
Yeah, I think I always, if you quote someone else who has more authority than you do, sometimes it helps. I think William Styron said that this is the most dangerous group of lunatics that have ever afflicted any government anywhere.
Uh-huh.
And I believe that that's true, and I believe that what happened in Oklahoma City, I mean, I'm not a Democrat, I'm not a partisan, I'm not someone who, you know, I don't think, you know, will be accused of trying to make political capital out of this, but these are people very similar in their beliefs and in their commitments to people who appear in public wearing coats and ties arguing that we should not ban semi-automatic weapons.
Well, now, what has happened to American individualism, Hal? This is a serious question. I mean, how do we figure out the continuity between our individual rights and the collective bad things that happen to us when, as a society, we allow something like the NRA to flourish?
Well, three quarters of the people in this country believe that we should have some sort of gun control, including, I think, something like 70% of people who own guns.
Uh-huh.
But then we have a case where a man running for the presidency of the United States, Senator Dole, actually is out there trying to repeal last year's ban on those, you know, automatic weapons. And that is absolutely incomprehensible to me. And I think, and even the president, when he was talking about this, he was making the same connection I'm making, but he felt necessary to talk over and over again about the Second Amendment and about, you know, saying, well, I'm a country boy and I've gone hunting myself.
Right.
There is no Second Amendment right. No, almost all reputable constitutional scholars say that the Second Amendment was, you know, for the militia, not for individual ownership, and that even if it did guarantee individual ownership of firearms, that was an extremely archaic thing that should be overturned. And yet this whole culture that we live in now, they seem to be much more interested in firearms than in children. And I think we're having a terrible problem where a minority in its ferocity, in its single-mindedness, has completely stifled debate and even in democratic process.
Hal, what is it that makes you laugh? I mean, this book, after all, is full of a lot of great good humor. You have a funny bone, and how do you respond to it?
Well, irony sort of shapes my life. I have a lot of anger, obviously. And without irony, I suppose I might have become some kind of a fanatic, assuming that I'm not. But I have the anger of a fanatic.
Uh-huh.
But I hope that I have the perspective and irony of someone who's, you know, steps back a little bit. I think I was going to say Roger Rosenblatt, a New York writer, declared the death of irony,
right?
I think 10 or 12 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And
a
lot of us are still feeding off the corpse, you know. But there's more opportunity for irony if you're not weeping. You know, if you're not actually down on your knees with tears streaming down your face,
right.
It's the best time in history for humorists.
And satirists.
Satirists.
Absolutely.
Although people don't appreciate satire the way they used to. I mean, literal-mindedness is also sweeping us along with fanaticism.
Do you think of yourself, Hal, as a public intellectual? I mean, that's a pretty serious sobriquet to apply, but how about it? You're out there on the barricades and preaching right thinking and the conclusions you want people to reach. How about that?
Oh, I come from a newsroom tradition where anyone who claims to be an intellectual will be immediately torn limb from limb by his colleagues. So
right.
I would never use that word. I think that, you know, I think that it's important for people to participate in the debate, and I think, you know, that the better education you have, the better you've had an opportunity to say to mix in your lifetime with people who are truly intellectuals and who do have a lot of really good ideas that, you know, that are being lost and shouted down.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's your permanent responsibility to circulate them as much as you can.
Hal, do you have any heroes, journalistic, cultural, political, otherwise? Who are the people that you? There's a lot of people in your book here that you love to damn. Who do you like to praise?
Well, we included in this book a whole chapter on heroes, and, you know, finally what we came down to was that, you know, it was somewhat negative, and you know, all my work hasn't been negative, but this particular collection was aimed toward a very dark view of American culture. So we chose a number of essays where a lot of them, unfortunately, were obituaries, where I was saying goodbye to people that I thought were wonderful.
So the heroes are all gone? Is that it?
They're not all gone, but it's amazing how many of them are people that represent a different time. You know, speaking of public intellectuals, Lewis Mumford was a man that I always admired, a man who was self-educated and who sort of found his own path and his own way of looking at society and so on, and just created this really fascinating body of work.
Well, now, do I hear the voice of nostalgia here, or what, just longing for the good old days, you just find yourself out of sync with what's going on now?
Unfortunately, I do. If I sound that way, I think that's fairly accurate. I find that I'm very interested in what older people have to say. Older than I am, I'm 50. Uh-huh. I find some of the best writing done by people who are no longer alive, people from other centuries even. And I really don't have too many idols. I mean, what was now regarded as the far left, I think Noam Chomsky, for instance, has an awful lot to say politically that people should listen to. But I don't have that many heroes, in the current media. I know there aren't that many people that I read. I often agree with Lewis Lapham. I read Russell Baker. I think he's an older man. Older men seem to have perspective. They seem to have irony.
Right.
And some of these fierce young people who are winning the prizes and acquiring the enormous circulation, they're intense and they're partisan in a way that makes me truly uncomfortable. I don't think we really have public intellectuals with authority anymore. People that really are willing to stand up alone and don't expect the comfort of having cheering sections. Almost none.
Hal, let's wrap up our conversation. Again, your book is Unarmed But Dangerous. Underneath all of this cynicism and criticism and the humor of your book, the pieces that you have here, are you really just a marshmallow who's a kind of romantic and an idealist at heart? Are you optimistic about the future of our country? What?
I am romantic. I am idealistic. I am sentimental. But I am totally pessimistic. As a matter of fact.
Well, that's what makes good writing, huh? That contradiction between the two?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I see the world that I, sort of hoped that I could help to make when I was, a really idealistic, very innocent person in my 20s. I don't see that world taking shape. And this is a personal grievance.
Hal Crowther is the author of Unarmed But Dangerous, a collection of essays available from Longstreet Press in Atlanta. In 1992, Hal Crowther won the H.L. Mencken Award. This is Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. I'll be back in just a moment with information about where to write for a cassette tape of this program. It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest this week was columnist Hal Crowther. Cassette tapes of the program are available for $10 postpaid. Our address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 770. That's $10, program number 770. Our address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. Next week on Soundings, Language and National Identity. Join me for a conversation with comparative literature specialist Michael Holquist of Yale University. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. Unarmed But Dangerous, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for a conversation with columnist Hal Crowther. He'll be here to talk about his new book, a collection of broadsides aimed at some of his favorite targets, including political correctness, polluters, and image-mongering celebrities. Crowther takes the measure of what he sees as all things phony, foolish, and fundamentally wrong with America today. Unarmed but Dangerous, some answers and insights from columnist Hal Crowther, this week on Soundings.